We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft. But Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink. Which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
From Pod World Headquarters, this is the Carolina Insider from Learfield.
We're back. Time for another edition of the Carolina Insider. Jones and Adam here with you. Adam, have you properly rested, relaxed, refreshed? Because I'm just going to tell you something, Adam. Starting today, for the next month and a half, it's go time.
Took up several new hobbies, did all my home improvement projects. That freeloader sure came in handy.
Yeah, it did.
And now I'm ready for the marathon.
Man, we are really getting into a busy stretch here. Football in the back half of the regular season, basketball getting started next week, fall sports moving into their NCAA or ACC and NCAA postseason time period here over the next few weeks, winter sports other than just basketball getting going. So there is a ton to talk about around Carolina. We're fired up. We're jazzed to be with you here for the next several weeks as we go through all of it. Now, Adam, as we referenced at the end of the show on Friday, a little bit of a different show today. We're going to we'll take a quick look at the weekend. We'll talk about football and basketball a little bit. We have a list and everything on the back half. But Adam, our guest today, we do have two guests today. We are focusing on a topic that has been brought to the forefront here recently with some incidents on campus, some very serious and tragic incidents about mental health of people in the young adult age range. And really mental health, I mean, we can talk about this for everyone, but we're focusing in the young adult age range and specifically with our interviews today with student athletes at Carolina. And so we have two guests to help us do that. Dr. Jenny Shannon, who works as a sports psychologist and the director
of athletic performance and psychology.
I think that's right, or close. Here at Carolina, we're going to talk to Jenny Shannon about what her role is, about her department's role, the services that they provide for student athletes, where they need help, where they've made strides, all those different things. And then, Adam, we are going to speak to Katie Grace Olinger, former softball player at Carolina, who had some very serious challenges in her life and is open to talking about them. And we'll go ahead and tell you, it's a very serious conversation. And I just say that in that we tackle some very serious subjects, including suicide and suicidal thoughts and tendencies. So, Adam, it isn't something I think that people are necessarily 100% comfortable talking about, but I also think that's part of the problem, right? And that's why we feel like these interviews today are going to be hopefully beneficial, is to hear some conversation about it, maybe better. I think you and I both learn stuff during these conversations, and hopefully makes it a little more normal, quote unquote, to have these discussions and to be out front with it.
And I think everyone is aware, hopefully, that we are not medical professionals.
Easy.
And so, I mean, Jones, as you'll later learn, is partway there. So I think we approach these as more informative for us and hopefully for you, just to try to understand more about a conversation that's moving more into our everyday life so that you can just have more information to participate in that and understand it.
So we'll have those coming up in just a little bit.
Well, and I will also say, sorry.
Adam, get out of this. Get out of Pod World headquarters.
I do think like the sports psychology side is a part of performance that is rapidly growing in importance. And I think that people are realizing it does have a real effect on field, on court performance. And you're going to see a big growth in that moving forward, I think. So even if you're not interested in the other part, that part of how you really reach your peak performance, not just physically, but mentally, because we talk about the physical part all the time. We talk some about the mental part and how you get prepared to compete at this level every single day.
And again, we'll get to these interviews in a minute. The number one thing I think that I took out of there was that they're just the lack of people, the lack of staffing. And it's not just at Carolina, but just the demand is larger than the supply right now, as far as people who feel like they need this service, would like this service. And then the amount of people that can provide the service is a little out of whack right now.
And I think the other thing I took out of it is that student athletes and just people in that age range are at a completely different place than some of us who are our age in terms of being conscious of this and aware of this and willing to talk about this. And you'll hear both Dr. Shannon and Katie Grace talk about how this is just kind of a normal part of that age range's everyday life. Whereas I think you and I don't really think of it that way because that's not how it was for us, but it's becoming more commonplace. It's just something we need to know more about. So that's what we try to do.
Okay. So that's coming up in just a little bit. The show in total, as Adam well knows, brought to you by LS Tractor. And a reminder that LS Tractor is sponsoring the Tar Heel rushing attack all season long out there on the football field. They commend the powerhouses and workhorses that clear the path and fight for every hard-earned rushing yard. And just like Carolina football's rushing attack, LS Tractor is proud to get your ground game going by offering super powerful landowners like Adam and me unparalleled strength, horsepower, and traction with their quality-built and reliable tractors. You can learn how you can experience the LS difference and do more for less by visiting LSTractorUSA.com. LSTractorUSA.com. Find a dealer near you. Carolina coming off a game in which it ran for 228 yards. That feels like a long time ago now against Miami. Ty Chandler had gone over 100 yards for the second time this year. Sam Howell was close. He was at 98, had 30 yards of lost yards primarily due to sacks. And Adam, I'm about 99% confident on this. If you did not take away the sack yardage, I think Sam Howell's the leading rusher at the quarterback position in the nation. If you don't take away the sack. So if you're just talking about gross yardage gained, then he actually leads the nation at that position. How wild is that to think about, that Sam Howell has matured his game in that way to that point?
it doesn't feel like it often happens that way where someone makes their reputation as a thrower and then becomes a runner.
Yeah, that's right. We've seen it the other way around more often.
Right. Like, I think when you thought of Marquise Williams, for example, you thought of runner first and then he became a passer. But I can't think of very many who went this way. But Sam Howell has done a great job, and it seems like I don't know if he enjoys it, but he certainly doesn't shy away from it, which I think he easily could. But, man, he does not. He'll run you over.
So a couple football notes, Adam, as Carolina gets back into game week here, and Notre Dame, the opponent, 7:30 on Saturday night. We'll break down that game and preview the Irish in our show later this week. But, Mack Brown met with the media this morning. I had a chance to talk to Coach Brown one-on-one for a long time this morning as well, and seemed like the focus during the bye week are things that you would anticipate. Getting younger players more reps in practice. At this point, you don't need to Sam Howell. You don't need to see Sam Howell. You don't need to see Tamon Fox. You don't need to see Jeremiah Gimmel as much. And so, really get some young guys elevated amount of work in practice. I think also, in that same vein, you're getting to that four-game point where guys can still redshirt if they play four games, but if they play five, they can't. And so you're trying to find out, okay, who here is, do we feel comfortable playing five or six games when it's all said and done, or more? And who do we want to try and keep the redshirt on, if at all possible? I think a lot of those discussions are being had. So there was that. There was just the self-scout aspect of it, and thought it was interesting. Coach Brown talked some about how, they will basically have coaches who go against, for example, maybe Tim Cross, the defensive line coach. You sit there and go, okay, Coach Cross, let's go through this with Stacy Searles, the offensive line coach. What are the things that you've seen from his group in practice or whatever that he can improve on? And that's something that happens, I think, all year long, but you have a little more time to maybe go a little more in depth when you reach this point of the year, the bye week. So I think that kind of stuff happened as well. And then, of course, and Mack Brown's been very open about it. He had a lot of discussions with players, and we've seen three Tar Heels go into the transfer portal: Chauffey Brown, Clyde Pender, and Josh Henderson. And Mack Brown basically shot up a warning flare a couple of times leading up to this bye week, saying, hey, we're going to have discussions with guys. We're going to be open and honest about where we see them fitting in. They're, those are going to be two-way conversations, of course, but you could see some players moving to the transfer portal. And so you never want to lose anyone, of course, Adam, but that's how it is now. You're going to have guys where this happens, I think, every single year. And so you have to be ready for that. You have to keep that conversation as open and honest as possible, and then you move on.
And Mack Brown was very complimentary of all three of those have brought to the program and their opportunities to play elsewhere. So this is not him talking, it's just me. I feel like I have a harder time getting adjusted to the in-season transfer portal than the postseason.
And so Coach Brown actually talked to him about that, where he said, you may have this conversation and go, okay, well, why not wait till the end of the year? Why not wait these extra, in this case with Carolina, five regular season games, and then the bowl game as well. He said a lot of times with it here is that you want to start trying to figure out where you want to go. You can go visit other places, and you don't want to get hurt. And so if you've made that decision, you don't want to put yourself at risk at that point. You want your value to be as high as possible, which of course it would dip if you're injured. And that's all fair game in this, I think, where we are now and with the transfer portal and how guys approach it. And then Coach Brown said from the team side of things, he said, and then at some point you also get to the question of, do I want a player? And let's be clear, we're not singling out any of these guys. This is just a general conversation here. Do I want a player who maybe isn't 100% invested anymore, who knows that they're going to be going somewhere else? For instance, this trip to Notre Dame, you only get to take a certain amount of guys. Would you rather have a younger player who is hungry for that opportunity. You know, would you rather have that quote unquote seat taken by that guy? And again, this is not about a single person that we're talking here. It's just a general discussion. And so it is different. I mean, it is different than 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. We understand that. And we've said before on here, I think Mac Brown is handling it the right way by being so out in front of it and open with it and just saying, this is going to happen. This is why it happened, you know, move on. But that doesn't make it any more normalized, I think. Eventually, I'm sure it will be. I still think we're in that phase where it just feels weird when it happens.
Do you think we're going to get to the point where in basketball we're seeing this around Christmas time? Because then it's even easier because you've got a natural semester break. I'm not really sure how the academic side works if you're transferring in October, but I'm sure they've got it all worked out. But basketball, I mean, if I don't play as much as I think I should in the pre-conference part of the year, and then the semester is over and I've taken my exams, what's to stop me from peacing out?
I think you absolutely will see it more in basketball. And I'm not saying here, although that could, I mean, it could happen here just like it could happen anywhere. But yes, I absolutely think it will. Because to your point, it's a much more natural break. And then you transfer somewhere and you're playing the next winter, you're playing.
Right.
So, yes is the answer, in my opinion. What do you think?
I think it probably would be foolish to think that that could not occur.
Yes. And I think it's really dangerous. Like, you could see that and go, man, what's happening at school X?
Right.
I don't think it's a... No, I'm not saying there couldn't be some problem where there is a large... But I think it would be silly to jump to that conclusion. That there's some kind of problem if people transfer out. I just think that's how it is now.
Yeah, I think it'll be more the exception when it doesn't occur.
Right.
And you'll be able to think, well, something there has really got people fastening on to them, whereas it's just like in football. I mean, three guys just left the team in midseason, and everybody was kind of like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Not because they don't value their contributions, but because that has become fairly standard.
So, in the roster management side of it, Mac Brown's talked a lot. I mean, just how impossible it is right now. And I think you throw in the COVID year and, you know, how much eligibility does each player have left, and are they going to take it? Are they not going to take it? And I think that's actually one of the positives on if someone is considering the transfer portal significantly and does elect to go in, at least now you know that spot is available.
I don't see how they do the roster management.
I don't
side.
Either.
In any of the sports, not just football, but football is the one we're talking about. The COVID year, the transfer portal, you still have to recruit high schoolers the way you used to, and you think you have this many spots, but really you're not sure. We've seen it this year just looking at other teams, trying to figure out who is what year doesn't make any sense because right. Everybody counts it differently.
Yeah.
At some 5 years from now, it'll all be evened out and we'll have it figured out again, but right now it's a giant mess.
Well, and I think one last point of this, is I would think that now also as a coach, you're trying to figure out what balance do I want to hit on my team of how many high schoolers do I want to go get, but then how many spots do I want to leave open because I feel like it'll be more beneficial to – certainly there's going to be some player who plays this position in the transfer portal that I would have a good chance to go get. I think everybody is figuring that distribution out in every sport.
What's the benefit of developing someone who's raw when 3 years from now you could go get someone who's a proven college player who already has done their development?
And think about it at like Ball State or Akron or something, where, I mean, and that's not a slap at those schools, but if you have somebody who's really, really good, and then all of a sudden in basketball, if Kentucky comes calling or Carolina comes calling, or you know, if a bigger school comes calling, chances of holding on to that player is probably not real high.
It's like how you felt about basketball 10 years ago when someone was having a great year and then you thought, oh, are they having too great a year?
Yeah.
Are they going to leave for the NBA? Well, I think if you're at Ball State or Akron, oh, they're going to win Conference Player of the Year? That's great. Oh, they're probably leaving.
Yeah. They'll be at Wake Forest next season.
Right.
I don't remember how we got started on that. I think just everything Carolina was trying to deal with during the bye week. But Adam, it did feel like a good time to just take a break, recharge a little bit. And Mac Brown, and he is as good at this as anybody, recalibrating that message and now what Carolina wants to do moving forward. And, you know, he's talked a lot about how before the Miami game, they really did with the team say, okay, first half of the season done. You know, this is a brand new season. He's already talking about how they're going to be the underdog in four of the five games that they have remaining and how, you know, they don't have any pressure on them. And so he is already shaping that message of what Carolina has in front of it. And the Tar Heels, as we've talked about multiple times, have a very difficult schedule. Four of their five remaining opponents are ranked, and they will be the underdog in most of those games. So we'll see how they perform.
Do have a very difficult schedule, but also do have the opportunity to basically write the story of this season.
Yes. And Adam, they can win every game left on it's such an odd place where the Tar Heels are, because I don't think any game left on their schedule do you go, there is no way they're winning that game. And sometimes there are those where you think the chances are really, really low. They can win every single game left. They could also lose a majority of the games they have left. I just don't know.
Well, and Mac Brown kind of referenced that, saying that he felt like Notre Dame had physical answers for everything Carolina was going to do the last time these teams play, and it's not necessarily that way this year. They're very good, but I don't think you feel like, oh, they're outclassing the Tar Heels in some significant way.
Yeah, that second half last year is one that he continues to circle, as I think a standard that they want to get to, that kind of thing doesn't happen.
And I know it sounds, I don't know, like we're just making stuff up, but it Carolina could be sitting here going to a really good bowl with a really good record on December 1st. They could also be sitting here not going to a bowl with a very poor record on December 1st. But the outcome of the positive of playing tough teams is if they win most of these games, nobody's going to remember Virginia Tech in December. Now, that being said, right now, that Virginia Tech loss really stinks. But it's already happened, and you could cancel it out by just going up to Notre Dame beating the Irish.
Yep.
In our hearts, not in the conference standings.
So Tar Heels back at it game week, heading up to South Bend on Friday. We will talk about Notre Dame, the matchup, etc. later in the week. I guess also technically later in the year, 4 days from now, 3 days from now. Adam, basketball had its closed scrimmage against Florida. There was an agreement between Carolina and Florida before the event that they were not going to share stats, final score, anything like that. Because in the past, we have had a guest on. Steve Kirscher's joined us a couple of times to talk about kind of in general what happened, not going hard X and O, but just what the event was like. But it's been very much more quiet this year. There was a 4 or 5 minute highlight package that the basketball account sent out on Sunday that had a bunch of highlights, bunch of shots being made by the Tar Heels. And so it occurred. We are aware that it occurred. We do know some stuff about it, but it's also been encouraged that information is not getting out. So we will honor that, of course.
And that's not a blanket agreement across the NCAA.
No, it's different, yes.
So you may see information from other team scrimmages or stats or play-by-play or whatever. That's just different. This is the agreement that Carolina made, and there's a variety of reasons why you would do that, some of which might make sense to you as a fan and some of which might not, quite honestly. But that's what Hubert Davis felt like was best, and if that's the case, then that's what's going to happen, and see you against Elizabeth City State.
Well, just by judging from that 5 minute highlight, Adam, Tar Heels must have shut Florida out.
Carolina's defense must be incredible. Justin McCoy's made a big difference.
So I do think, and just in talking to some of the coaches beforehand, Adam, they were very excited to just go and kind of see where they all stood against a quality opponent who's, you know, Power 5 team, good coach in Mike White. I mean, you know what Florida is. And so they were excited to go get some feedback against somebody else that they felt could be beneficial. And so, and that's the ultimate goal of this thing, is to do just that. And so you also, because that's going to be tougher competition than obviously Elizabeth City State, and that's not a knock against them. But Carolina will be much more talented than Elizabeth City State. The value that you get there is that you're playing in front of a crowd. The lights are on, you run out of the tunnel, just all the things to get back into that flow. And the goal of this was something different than that.
And I think just the logistics of playing it on the road will help you when you go to College of Charleston that second week of the regular season. Preparing for a game away from your home, not having your gym to go shoot in whenever you want to, eating, traveling, things like that, being able to get all that stuff out of the way for the first time will help when you're doing it for the second time.
So a week from Friday is the exhibition matchup with Elizabeth City State. Also, just learned today that Wake Forest game, 6-day hold at them.
Boo! Yeah.
So don't know the time of that Wake Forest football game and won't know it until this upcoming Sunday, which is a big old negativo.
You're trying to get me started, and I'm not going to get started, but I'm just going to say that hurts attendance.
Yeah, doesn't help anybody.
People will make decisions this week on whether or not they're going to that game, and they'll decide no because they don't know what time it is, and they'll make other plans. The end. But it'll be on a good TV network.
Adam, anything else, football, basketball, that you want to touch on before we get to our interviews?
No.
Okay. So let's get to our double interviews here. Again, focusing on mental health. We've got Dr. Jenny Shannon. We've got Katie Grace Olinger. We'll get both those right there back to back. Come back out, get into the back half of the show here on the Carolina Insider.
I think we've talked about most every way that a Carolina student athlete could improve their game. We've talked about lifting weights. We've talked about reps with coaches. We've talked about individual work in the summertime. And I don't think we've ever talked about mental health, which we are learning is important, Jones. So today, really excited to be joined by Dr. Jenny Shannon, who's Carolina's Director of Mental Health and Performance Psychology.
You did it, Adam.
Yes. Got it. I didn't even have to write it on my hand. Dr. Shannon, thanks so much for coming by.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate any opportunity that we get to have a conversation about mental health, which, like you said, often gets missed in the conversation about athletes.
Now, I was able to recall your title, which I'm impressed with myself. What does that exactly mean that you do?
Great question. And you crushed it. It was awesome. So I do a lot of things. The two main things are working with the mental health of our student athletes. And so I'm a licensed psychologist, which means my graduate training was in how to help people with issues like depression, anxiety, eating disorders. So we serve our student athletes doing individual appointments around that. But the other side of it is also the performance psychology side. So I'm a certified mental performance consultant. And with that, I work on the mental game, things like confidence, focus, athlete-specific concerns like coming back from injury and coping with the mental side of that, team dynamics. So we do those in individual sessions as well as team sessions with many of our teams here at Carolina. I've got a staff of 3 full-time people, myself included, and we do our best to meet the needs of the 800 student athletes.
I was going to say, 3 people and 800 student athletes, I would assume that could be overwhelming at times. How do you guys try and manage all of that?
It has been really hard. So it's been fascinating because when I started, I was the first full-time provider that we'd ever had. We'd had kind of part-time. Bradley Hack has been here for a long time in a part-time capacity. But in January of 2017, that was the first time we had even one full-time provider. Mm. And then we've grown a ton, but it's been a if you build it, they will come. Over and over and over again. Literally every year we have had a wait list. We are people who can only see so many people at one time. And, you know, for better or for worse, we see them for a long time. Sometimes because they're struggling and need a lot of help, but other times because they just want to optimize their performance. They want to optimize their health and well-being. And we want to be able to support that in them. And so we've done the best we can. But honestly, like, it's been a struggle to meet the demand that we've had. Longer we're here, the more the athletes talk to each other, the more teams want to use our services. And, you know, there's only so many hours in the day or week.
Sure.
So we've tried to get creative with groups, with team sessions, kind of maximize our time in that way. But it's been a struggle, to be perfectly honest with you.
How do you find that even since 2017, the willingness of student athletes to come talk to you has changed and say, this is something I would like help with?
That has been one of the changes that I have been so proud of in this department that I think has been so incredible. And I'll be honest, it has come from the student athletes. There is such a stigma around mental health in general, but in athletics in particular. The culture around athletics just broadly is very much toughness, walk it off, suck it up, you know, don't show any weakness. And unfortunately, we equate mental health with weakness sometimes. And so what we've seen make a huge difference is the student athletes talking to each other, the student athletes being more and more willing to tell their stories. And we've seen that in a couple ways. Within teams, they talk to each other. I think one of the coolest things we see is when someone's leaving Stallings and they're like, hey, I'm going to talk to Jenny. I'll see you later. Just like they would if they were going to talk to the dietitians or their athletic trainers. But we've also been able to have some really cool events over the years where student athletes tell their stories in front of each other. We've had TED Talks, we've had panels, and every time we have one of those events, my inbox is flooded the next day with people who said, I had no idea others were going through this. I had no idea that this was something we could talk about. And so it's been really powerful to see that shift over and over again. And I think that's been so much of the, if you build it, they will come. The more we're there, the more we see people, the more they talk to each other, they keep showing up. And so I think that stigma has been reduced so much just by the courage of the student athletes to talk about their stories.
All right, I have two questions. The first one, outside of the student athletes, outside of, how can others start removing the stigma that you just said you felt like was, how can that start to lessen, you think?
I think there's a couple ways. One is for us to start to change our language around mental health and see it as a part of health, not separate from health. You know, when we have someone with an injury, an illness, physical illness, we can see that. We can see that they're wearing a cast, a brace, whatever. We can see that they're sniffling and not feeling well. We can't always see mental health. And so sometimes we put it somewhere different. But the reality is, it is a part of our health. We all have mental health, every single one of us. Sometimes it's good. Sometimes it's not so good. So I think starting to change the language around it to just being health in general and talking about it as such. I think the other thing is just an openness from everybody to share more about what they're going through. Like, everybody's going through something. Everybody has struggles. And the more people that talk about, you know, I've been depressed, I've had anxiety, I've gone to therapy, I take medication, or the more people that can be supportive when somebody else tells them this, I think that's what really changes it, that it becomes normalized. There's so many of us that struggle with this, and yet it's the thing we don't talk about. So I think giving it voice, asking each other, how are you doing? How are you really doing? Listening, responding, and again, just our own openness about our struggles. I think that's the other thing. And I think the last thing is to make it accessible. And that's a much bigger societal issue than we can solve today on this podcast.
Oh, don't you underestimate us now.
I would love, if you can do that, oh man, that would be amazing. I have no doubt. But I think that would be the other thing, if we can make it accessible.
Okay, I want to make sure I ask this in a way that makes sense, because it could come off as ugly, and I don't mean it ugly. How do you find the balance of, for an athlete, being willing to discuss this and talk and have these open conversations? But then I think at some point when you're in the field of competition, you can almost think too much. Like, you don't want to be in your own head, I guess, for lack of a better term. How do you find that balance of still being able to compete freely while also being okay to talk about all these type of things away from the field of competition? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, no, okay. That's an awesome question. And I think this is sometimes why people are scared to even have the conversation. They're like, if I open this up, I'm not going to be able to shut it down and show up on game days. So I think that's a fantastic question. And this is where, like, the mental health and performance side meet beautifully. So an initial thought is, in my experience, people who are taking care of their mental health off the field do better on the field. It's really hard to be at your best if if you're super anxious or super depressed or anything else related to mental health. So by giving it space off the field, you can show up more ready to perform. You can show up with a clearer head, more able to kind of turn it on and be where you need to be. So I think that's one part of it. I think we're more actually free to perform in the way we need to. The other thing is we can have kind of routines and rituals and ways of kind of shifting gears. Mm. We can really work to be locked into what we're doing while we're doing it. A lot of what I teach with folks on the performance side is present moment focus. And so it doesn't mean your other stuff doesn't still exist, but we realize that, okay, in this moment, I need to be where my feet are. I need to be right here, right now, and I'll take care of myself in the other ways afterwards. You know, obviously we see times that separation can't happen. Like, think of Simone Biles at the Olympics this summer. Like, that was a great example of recognizing there was a threshold where her physical safety was threatened. But in most cases, if you're taking care of it off the field, you can develop some really good skills and strategies to then be kind of locked in and fully present with where you are. And I actually think you have more capacity to do that if you're talking about it, taking care of it, getting what you need outside of competition. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Coaches, I think, in general, can sort of lean towards the older school. How do you convey to them that when a student athlete comes to see you, that's not that much different than working on their free throw technique or taking some swings in the cage or whatever?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think historically, that has been one of the barriers in sports psychology, is coaches viewing it differently. I think we're seeing a shift in that as well. But I think part of it is really on the mental health side, really hitting home the point that athletes with good mental health perform better. We just know that. We have research to back that up. We have tons of anecdotal evidence to back that up. We can see it happen. And so helping them understand that this is a part of optimizing performance. If your athlete's not in a good headspace, it's going to be really hard for them to be at their best under pressure when stakes are high. The other thing is just kind of really framing it as these are skills we train. Just like we train the physical skills, we need to train focus. A coach yelling at you to focus doesn't make you focus. You've got to tell them how to focus. You've got to practice the ways of focusing. And I think sometimes putting it in the context of training on the performance side is helpful. But I mean, I think generally speaking, we like to believe that coaches have their athletes' well-being on their hearts and that that's important to them. And we want to make sure we take care of them as people first. And then we can also have the kind of added bonus that their performance is going to benefit from this. If they are in a good headspace, they will show up better. If they train these skills, which are trainable, both on the mental health therapy side and the performance psychology side, they're going to optimize their performance. So it can be a tough sell, but we're working on it.
You mentioned Simone Biles. I had a hard time figuring out what I thought about that. And on the one hand, good job thinking about yourself and realizing you weren't there. But on the other hand, it was hard to figure out how I felt about the rest of the team as it related to her not being there. So how do you tell student athletes to balance taking care of themselves versus taking care of this team that they're part of?
Yeah, that's always a really, really tough balance. And I think a lot of student athletes feel pressure around that. And it's going to be such an individual case-by-case situation. You know, I don't think there's a good blanket answer, but I think it's making sure we're giving space and time to like really look at what is going on for me. What are the potential consequences for myself? And in the case of Simone Biles with the twisties, like that could have been her life. You know, I'm a former gymnast, so I understand that phenomenon very well, unfortunately. And it's terrifying. You know, hers was a mental health issue that threatened her safety. That's not always the case, but sometimes it can be. And so I think it's got to be a balance. When I think about a lot of the teams here at Carolina and with, you know, what I've known of this Olympic gymnastics team, everybody trains to be ready if someone's out. If it was an ACL, no one would even think twice about it, right? Like nobody would question that. Like, okay, we'll step up. You didn't choose this. Well, we don't choose mental health either. Like if we struggle with mental health, we don't make that choice. We can treat it. It's very treatable, but that can take time, just like with a physical injury. So to me, it comes back to, again, equating it to physical health and treating it the same way and analyzing like, okay, is this in my best interest? Will I be safe? And then really hoping that teams are in a place where they want what's best for their teammates and they understand and are also ready to step up. I mean, that's what we train for all the time.
So we've seen here recently some very serious issues on campus dealing with mental health. It just seems like there is a lot of, I don't know if pressure's the right word, but maybe it is, mm-hmm. on people in this age range that you talk to every single day. What are some things that 40-year-old Jones and Adam or whatever 40-year-old Tar Heel fan that we don't get, that an 18 to 22-year-old or whatever is feeling right now that you can, obviously not speaking on a case-by-case basis, sure. but general discussion that you hear some?
Absolutely. Well, I think one thing to start off with is the most common age for a mental illness to show up for the first time is between 18 and 24. And that's just around brain development, like just how our brains develop in that age range. Regardless of any other pressures, everybody in the 18 to 24-year-old range is at a higher risk for a first episode of depression, anxiety, something like that. And so these kids are already at a higher risk just by virtue of that. So we're coming in with that. I think, secondly, we look at a place like Carolina, and it is intense. Like, I went to the University of Arizona. Love it. Amazing. Not quite the same academic caliber as here. No shame on my Wildcats, I'm just saying. So I look at what it's like here, and everybody here was their valedictorian and was involved in all the things, and it's really easy to get pulled into the comparison. It's really easy to have this sense of I've got to be perfect, and it's really easy to feel alone in your struggles because everybody's trying to look like they have it all together. I think that's one of the big things we hear is that they look around them and they don't think anybody else is going through this, and they think there's something wrong with them, that they're struggling. So they've got the high intensity, the high pressure of the academics, a really, really tough culture to just be open and vulnerable in yourself and allow yourself to make mistakes. And then for our student athletes, just that next level of what their schedules look like, the demands that are on them, the expectations, the fact that they're in the public eye. There's just so many pieces that don't allow for the time and space to just be, first of all, that don't allow for the time and space to take care of yourself in the way you may truly need to. And again, because we look at mental health differently, they don't feel like they can take a day off from it for it. They don't feel like they can, you know, talk to somebody about it, and they don't always get the help that they need because of that. Not to mention, like, everyone's under-resourced in this department. So even if they get to the place of being ready, they may have to wait. They actually at this point will have to wait. And that can be really hard. So I think it's this combination of just this stage of life is hard, and the environment of a really high level, high achieving university adds a ton of constant pressure, as well as just a demanding lifestyle that doesn't give the space to take care of ourselves.
Okay, I have another two-part question.
All right, I'm ready.
Number one, what role does social media play in these pressures, and how do you discuss social media, if at all, with people who come to talk with you?
Yes, great question.
Thank you. Adam, take that.
I mean, absolutely. I think that's one of the things that we have seen add to that comparison culture. It's one of the things we've seen add to the, like, everybody's got it all together, because, you know, look at their reels, look at their TikTok videos, look at their posts, like, what a perfect life they're living. And we can talk about all day long of like, okay, that's curated, that's photoshopped, that's edited. But in the moment you see it, it's hard not to get caught up in that. And unfortunately, it does become a culture of like, how many likes did I get? How many followers did I get? And to be honest, I think NIL has really complicated that for our student athletes too. It's adding an extra pressure with that. So I think social media is really tough in adding to that pressure and that comparison. And then honestly, it becomes a little bit of a, we all know it's somewhat of a time suck, but it's one of the things that then replaces the little bit of time that might be used for some actual self-care, some actual ways of helping ourselves, because it feels like an escape. It feels like a good way to kind of check out and like take a mental break. But in reality, we're getting so much stimuli from that, and it's like activating so many different parts of us that might not actually be helping us. We feel like we're taking a break, but our brains are actually getting more activated in a way that's not super helpful. And so, yeah, we do talk about it. I'll tell you, it's a hard sell to get this group on board.
Just get rid of your Instagram account. That's what I'm telling you to do.
I mean, yeah, not happening for most. I have had people take like social media breaks and they're like, oh my gosh, that was amazing, or that was terrifying. Like, I had to be with my thoughts, and that's a lot.
Nobody wants that.
Right, right. It's real uncomfortable to be with our thoughts. So, I mean, little things like that, but even things I'll talk about, like taking a walk from one building to the next on campus where you are just like mindful and present, not scrolling on your phone, not texting somebody, like even building in little breaks or setting some boundaries with your phone, you know, little things like that to get some space, as well as being really mindful of like, who do you follow and who's not good for you to follow? You know, I work with a lot of eating disorders, and we have to be real careful about who people follow around that. You know, but with anything, there are some really great social media accounts that promote mental health and really good things around these topics, but there's a lot of damaging ones as well.
Okay, so this is a related question, but different, I think. And it's a little theory that I have, and I want to see if you agree with it.
Okay, I'm ready.
Two trained professionals.
Yeah, that's
stressing it right here on just, the pod.
Just chopping it up, Adam. So I think part of the pressure for younger folks is they have so much information. Like, I didn't know what was going on in Afghanistan or something when I was 10 years old. You know what I mean? But now it's right there at your fingertips all the time. And it can be terribleized, I think, in your mind a little bit, where all you see is all these different. Do you agree with that in any way? That it's just like you have, and all I'm looking for is validation. No big deal.
Everybody needs validation. But it's okay.
It just feels like everybody has so much information all the time that you can start getting overwhelmed by that.
I'm absolutely.
See,
yes.
Adam.
You're on it.
Yep.
You're on it. Absolutely. Also, I like your term terribleized.
Thank you.
I might coin that.
I'm sorry. It's trademark.
But no, you
got a lot of trademarks on this podcast. So if you're willing to pay, we're willing to give it up.
That's a good one. We're not quite funded enough to buy it, but I'll work on it. But I mean, that's true. I mean, I think that's true for all of us. And whether college aged, you know, I've got young kids at home and I worry about what they're going to get exposed to. And then those of us who are not as young anymore, sure. You know, it's a lot and it's constant. And you have to be really intentional about choosing what you consume and separating from what's not serving you well, you know, and finding that balance of like, yes, we want to be informed, but there's a point where it is just no longer helpful. And I think everybody's got to be really aware of that. And, you know, I'm big on like, check in with yourself, like know when you're at that place where you're feeling overwhelmed and make a mindful choice about where you direct your attention. It doesn't have to be all this all the time. But yes, validation, you're 100% correct.
Yeah.
Dr. Jones
yeah,
Angel.
That's right. Feels like that's an honorary PhD right there.
I'll get you licensed by the board. Don't worry. I got you.
If you were a knee surgeon, we would all understand a good outcome when you operate on someone is, oh, I see them out there participating and running up and down whatever field, and I understand how that worked. What's a good outcome for you? How do you know when it worked?
That is also a fantastic question.
Fantastic.
You guys nailing it. I mean, that's a really hard part too, I think, about just how we show our value in our service, because you're absolutely right. One, we can't see an objective outcome as easily. We also don't have concrete timelines. You tear your ACL, okay, we know you're going to be about a 9-month recovery. We can't say that with mental health. And so the way we know is, again, case by case, so much of what we do. But I think when people start being symptom free or reduced symptoms, because every mental health condition has symptoms, just like any other health condition. So when we see a reduction in those symptoms, but I think for me, a lot of it is when they are functioning in the way they want to, because most of the time, mental health will impact functioning in school, in sport, in relationships, like all those important areas. So when people get back to feeling like themselves, to to functioning at a high level in the way they want to feeling like they can show up in the way that they want to, and to be in a place where obviously we all have ups and downs and good days and bad days, but overall are feeling like okay with how they're moving through life and feeling like they're able to move towards their goals in a meaningful way, engage with people in their lives in a meaningful way, and just feel like they can do life in a meaningful way. And so the symptoms we can measure a little bit more, like we can say like, okay, your mood's improved, you're sleeping better, things like that, less worried thoughts. But some of it is just really the subjective experience of like, okay, I'm back to doing life in a way that I want to, and that feels good.
All right, before we let you go, if you could wave your wand and things would be the way that you want them to be right now for your department, is that more people? Is it more infrastructure? What needs to happen to get? And I mean, I'm saying some Wednesday afternoons I'm available sometimes if you need anything.
We may contract with you. I mean, you told me you could change mental health care in society, so I'm counting on you to make this magical thing happen. Okay, what I would love to see it be, I mean, people is first and foremost. Like, we are not a service that needs a lot of stuff. We need a room, and we need people, because it's 45 to 50 minute sessions. You know, we can only do so many of those.
Sure.
And so we need people. In my perfect magic wand world, we would be like athletic trainers and be, you know, assigned to teams in a very similar way, or have the same number of folks to be able to not only see folks without a wait list, but also to be more responsive when urgent needs come up, when people just need a sooner appointment. Like, our schedules are so slammed that it's really hard to accommodate some of that stuff. So more people would be first and foremost. And then I think with that, to have the ability to be more integrated in more places, like get coaches trained up more, get other staff trained up more, so they can feel really confident and comfortable in managing the situations. Not doing the therapy, we'll leave that to you.
Yeah, but sure. Yeah. Look, only the trained professionals,
right, exactly,
on that.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'd like to thank Dr. Jones, who made this all possible.
But to make sure that everybody on the front lines with student athletes, everybody that's student athlete facing, feels confident and comfortable in handling some of these things. And then, yeah, I mean, I think with the infrastructure, just like having it seen, doing all the things we can to be as connected to every department and as integrated as anything else. And just, again, seen as normal, no big deal. This is just what we do here. And we consider this in the realm of how student athletes perform optimally and how we support their wellness. But people, 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 we need all the people.
We get our guests through a wide variety of ways. Sometimes we just see them walking by and we reach out and grab them and force them to come in here.
Flag them down.
But sometimes listeners send us really good ideas, because usually the listeners are smarter than us. No. Kevin Davis is responsible for today's guest, Katie Grace Olinger, because he sent us an interview with Katie Grace and said, "I have found the next guest that needs to be on the show." Well, I mean, so Kevin, Katie Grace is here.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you for the booking, and please send us an invoice and Jones will pay it. Katie Grace, thanks so much for coming by.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
For people who aren't Kevin, tell folks a little bit about Katie Grace and why you're here and why you're a Tar Heel.
Yeah, so I came into Carolina to play softball in the fall of 2017. Had a pretty normal freshman year, but then my sophomore year started really struggling with some mental health issues. And I was pretty public about what I was dealing with, just because I didn't, you know, I was super open with my team. I didn't feel like I could really find the help I needed. Just overall, and I didn't want other people to have to deal with that. So I felt like that's kind of why my story got attention at first, was just all the ups and downs of it and being super open. And then I also decided to medically retire after my junior year, and actually ended up undoing that last spring and coming back and playing. So that made a lot of noise, just because not a lot of people had done that before. But taking the time away from the sport allowed me to like get where I needed to be mentally, and then come back and be able to perform again. And it was crazy, but super neat, and a very unique story that, you know, I think I've had a lot of people in sports reach out to me since then, just athletes, you know, asking for help, advice, all the different things. And it's really special to be able to help people and to be able to show people that, like, you can come back and do it, or you can recover from an eating disorder in athletics, and all those different situations that when you're dealing with it personally, it feels super isolating. So just kind of, yeah, being helpful.
So why were you comfortable being open with your challenges? Why was that something where you said, you know what, I think it's better if I talk to people about this?
Yeah, I think I was super supported by my team and my coaches. So I was very open with them, which allowed me to kind of own what I was going through. Also, my coaches really encouraged me to, you know, own my story, own what was going on. And it was super empowering to be able to not be embarrassed by it, but to be like, listen, this is what I'm dealing with. And like, I'm trying to navigate through it. And I love all of your support. And I think I just didn't want there to be questions. And I think that a lot of people, that's not something they'd be comfortable with. And it's totally just like a difference in, you know, to each their own kind of thing. But I thought there was so much power in being like, this is my struggle. This is what I'm working to overcome. And I'll hopefully be back soon.
How did you know something was off?
I got really sick really quickly. My sophomore year, it started out just with anxiety and kind of in the realm of sports. So I redshirted that year. But then it just took like a really dark turn. The more we like tested with medications and stuff, I got very suicidal and was actually ended up in UNC hospitals for a little while. I was very sick and I was very unlike the usual me. And it was like, it was very alarming to me and to, you know, my teammates and coaches, but I knew something was very wrong.
Okay. This is a delicate question to ask. It's a weird question to ask probably. Mm-hmm. Like suicidal thoughts. Okay. What are those like? How did you know that it was more than just the maybe typically, man, I just hate what's going on kind of thoughts that I think everybody probably has every now and then? How did you know that it was more severe than that?
Yeah, so I was diagnosed with an anxiety disorder when I was 7. Like, I've had my fair share of mental health struggles, but I've never experienced suicidal thoughts. And the first time when it started to happen, I wouldn't say it's like an all of a sudden thing, but it was just like this, I could not be alive and I'd be okay with it. And it kind of starts as those like passive thoughts. And it quickly became like the darker the hole I got into of like not being able to find the help I needed, the more I was like, I feel like a lost cause. I feel like there's no help out there for me. And I feel like the world would be better off with me not being here. And I just think, you know, there's passive and active suicidal thoughts. And I think that I was kind of between both of them. But once you start experiencing that, you know, and it's very scary to be scared of yourself and your own thoughts. And I felt very impulsive, like I could act on them at any time. And like, I feel like it's interesting because I always talked about how like the little things that my teammates would do, how much they meant to me. And mm-hmm. I think it was because the smallest thing, good or bad, could send me, like, could save me or be the end of me. Like, I was so sensitive to everything going on around me. And I think that's why you hear, like, those stories where, you know, someone does something kind and it, like, makes a person decide they want to stay here. I think that it's interesting how vulnerable you are in that situation, and it's unlike anything I'd ever experienced before.
Okay, you said a couple times that you didn't feel like you could get the help you needed. Mm-hmm. Like, where was the lack of help? Was that a Carolina thing? Was that a you didn't know where to go? Like, where was the breakdown there?
Yeah, I've always been very, I've always been encouraged to be very careful about, you know, what I say and but honestly, it was a Carolina thing. And that's why over the last couple weeks, I've been really sad hearing about everything going on here, because honestly, it doesn't surprise me. I did everything right. My coaches referred me to CAPS. I went to CAPS. I couldn't get, you know, an appointment longer than 30 minutes and with someone who was, you know, a...
And real fast, what's CAPS if people don't know?
Campus...
Something on campus.
Yes, it's a psychological services on campus.
Got it.
And so, you know, I couldn't get an established appointment. I couldn't get on anyone's schedule. I was having my medication changed all the time. So I ended up deciding I was going to go look outside of Carolina because I needed more. And then I couldn't find, you know, a psychologist that could get me on the schedule within 2 months. Like it was, there was just no immediate care I could find. And nothing that could give me any sort of structure around my mental health. It was like, we have an appointment here and then 3 weeks from now. And I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to be here 3 weeks from now. Like I am on like a day by day crisis situation and I couldn't find the help. And it was always like, you know, the emergency room is the last straw, like that will save me. And I went into the ER and it was the worst experience of my entire life. It was, yeah, I mean, I got out and I was 10 times worse than I was going in. And it's one of those things where it's like, I'm so lucky I had the coaches and the team around me that was able to, you know, support me through that time. But had I not had them, like, I genuinely know I wouldn't be here. So for people at Carolina with, you know, without those resources, it just makes me really, really sad.
It makes me really sad. like, I've got college age kids, and like to think about you walking around feeling that way out there, like that could be my kids. So we're old.
What, Adam is old.
We're both old. What do we need to be more attuned to be able to see when somebody's dealing with something that's not like a hurt knee or a cast on their leg or something?
Yeah, it's hard. I think it's just making sure that like every space that you have people in, they feel, you know, comfortable and safe being around you. Because at the end of the day, if you're, you know, if you care about the people you come in contact with and you're a kind person, like it's so hard because there's nothing anyone can do unless, you know, you feel comfortable opening up to someone or, you know, letting them in. But I think that at the end of the day, like, It's the little things of just showing the people around you that you care about them, because you can't help everyone, and not everyone wants to be helped by certain people. You know, like I had a select, my pitching coach was the person who like I needed during that time, and she was incredibly helpful, and I was really blessed. But it's like if someone's not comfortable opening up to you about it, it's hard to be, you know, anything more than what they want you to be. I don't know. That's a tough question. That's because there's not much like regular people can do unless you're close to that person and just supporting them. But I think, and it's also encouraging people to get like real medical, like go to a medical provider, like a psychologist or a psychiatrist. I think you cannot support somebody with severe mental health issues like suicidal thoughts. You can't support them without the help of a medical professional, because it's too much.
So we talked to Dr. Jenny Shannon from Carolina, and she talked about how she feels like progress is being made, that they still need more personnel, and you know, there's still some challenges that you talk some about. Have you seen, from the student-athlete perspective, have you seen some growth in that area?
Yeah, I mean, I think that... You know, the psychological services for athletes, like, they're awesome. But I think when I was struggling, they didn't have it was just Dr. Shannon.
Right.
So I think that now that they've added people to their staff, it's huge, because then it was like, I can't get in with her and I need her. And she's so helpful once you are in with her. So it was kind of maddening. But now that they've added people, it's huge, because as a medical professional, you know, you're having to look out for these signs of like people are struggling mentally, and, you know, the signs that someone's suicidal. And it's like, if you're overworked and over, you know, you have too many people that you're looking out for, it's really hard to give people, you know, the effective individualized care that they need. So I think that adding people and resources is huge.
How do you, and we talked some with her from her perspective on this, There is a stigma, unfortunately, still around mental health. And I think especially when you get into athletics, there's the, just be tougher than that. How do we get past that? How can, from your point of view, how can that begin to change?
Yeah, I think that, this might like not come out right, so just bear with me.
Don't worry.
Most of
what we say comes out really goofy, okay. So it doesn't matter at all.
Okay, so I think there's been a really great step in the right direction in terms of like stigma around the moderate to mild mental health issues in athletics. Like, you know, I struggle with anxiety or depression, and that's all great. Like, it's a great first step. But for the athletes who have severe mental illnesses, it's like, okay, it's okay to struggle, but to a certain point. Mm. And then, like, once someone is suicidal or they're ending up in the hospital, it's like, we don't know what to do with this. Like, there's still a huge stigma around that level of mental illness.
Sure.
And even, like, the Simone Biles situation this past summer, you know, it's like, mental health is fine until it affects her performance and she can't perform for a team and everyone hates her for it. You know, it's like, I've had the yips in softball, so I get what she, like, she forgot how to do something she's done her entire life. And it's insane the effect that, like, a mental health issue can have on your performance. Like, I threw a changeup every single game for my entire career. It was my best pitch. I forgot how to throw it when I was struggling majorly with my anxiety. Like, I couldn't throw the pitch, and it was just, it's crazy the effect that your mind has on your physical ability to play your sport. And I think that we accept mental health issues on a minor level in athletics, but once it gets to a certain point where, like, she just needs to stop playing then, which maybe that's true, but our level of support for people really struggling is not there, I don't think.
How did you turn the corner?
Honestly, COVID really was huge for me, being able to take a step back from the sport. And I had my fiance, he's in the minor league, so he was home. And it was the first time I'd had, like, people around me 24/7. And being able to take a break from softball is what ended up making me decide I needed to medically retire. You know, the world of athletics is so go, 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 go hard, ignore your feelings, ignore what your body's feeling, what your body's telling you. And at the end of the day, that made me really, really good at having an eating disorder. That made me really sick. And I think it makes a lot of athletes really sick, and they don't realize it because it's so accepted in athletics. So I realized I needed to take a step back from that. And until then, I didn't fully recover from my eating disorder. My anxiety is still an issue. It'll always be an issue. I've come to accept it, and I've come to, like, find different ways to cope besides athletics and exercise, which is also what made me really sick. So I think it was just support and taking a break, taking a step back from, like, that go, go, go all the time, ignore what you're feeling. Yeah.
You're sitting here and we're talking like everything is fine and everything's all fixed and we'll just all carry on with the rest of our day. Is it fixed, or is it something you have to be mindful of all the time from today forward?
It's definitely something I have to be mindful of. You know, I'm in remission from my eating disorder. In terms of that, I'm doing great. My mental health will always be something I have to stay on top of, because if I ignore it, I'll get to that same place I was in. And that's what I've come to realize is, like, because I pushed things down for so long, it all came up at once, and it was unbearable for me to try to deal with all of that and athletics at the same time. So I think that, it's just a matter of staying on top of it and making sure I'm okay and making sure I have people around me who know my past and, you know my tendencies and can, like, call me out and be like, listen, you're doing that. And, like, that's never led you to a great place. So that's super helpful.
I have a ton of respect for people your age when it comes to the fact that you've had the internet and social media your entire life. Like, it's just been part of your life. How do you try and manage that, of whether it's what pictures you see and that you put out there or the comments that you get from people. How do you put that in perspective with what I consider to be kind of everyday life? But I'm guessing that that's everyday life to you and people your age. Does that question make sense?
No, it does. I think social media, I had to learn how to use it to my benefit, because when I was really struggling in athletics, my entire social media was tailored to like how to be the best athlete, how to lose weight, how to, you know, optimize my health and well-being. And when I started in my recovery, I had to unfollow all of those accounts. And I really had to like create, I guess, a reel of like things that helped me. So like following people who were athletes, who were my size, who were, you know, strong, athletic, intuitive eating, different things that were like very helpful to me in my recovery. It was unfollowing things that made me feel bad about myself and following things that helped me be the healthiest version of myself. And it felt so small when I did it. And then after a while of like having that social media tailored to like me and what I needed, it like completely changed my perspective on myself and like on the benefits of social media in terms of being able to be healthy. It doesn't have to be a negative thing. You just have to be willing to like make adjustments to, you know, make it work for you.
If you're playing a sport at Carolina, you're one of the best in the country at your sport, who's also at an elite academic institution, and you've always been very competitive and driven and focused on this single thing that you've always been good at. What's kind of the crossover between that mindset that got you here and then also being mindful of the other parts of your life that make you a healthy person?
Right. So I think that it's worked for a lot of the athletes through high school and their level of perfectionism, and it's not sustainable in college, especially when you have the pressure of you're no longer the best, you are one of the best, and you have to keep working and keep getting better to maintain being the best. And it is such a dark hole of like, how far will you go? Like, you've done 20 hours this week, you know, you've worked out this long, and you're going to go in and you're going to do extra because you want to beat out, you know, your teammates. Or it's not sustainable when, you know, the results of athletics, you don't know what the outcome's going to be. You know, like, I could put in all the time and all the energy, and I don't know that I'm going to have a good game. You know, I know I've put in the work, but the results aren't there. And that's what I was experiencing, was like, I wasn't getting the results that matched the level of, you know, dedication and commitment I was giving to my team and, you know, the sport and my position. And it's exhausting. And it made me so anxious that I like couldn't sustain it, because I couldn't be perfect. I couldn't guarantee success. And it ended up completely like ruining my career, that trying to be perfect. And it was only when I came back my senior year after not practicing for 8 months and got on the field that I was like, this is actually really fun. And I like am doing really well, and I haven't practiced. And it's because I've let go of that wanting to be perfect, and I'm just here having fun, enjoying a sport that I've done since I was little. So that was very interesting, kind of giving up that like I need to be perfect and just going out there and doing what I love and competing with people who were my friends and teammates, completely changed the game. And it changed, you know, the way I saw the sport at the end of my career.
How do student athletes talk about mental health? Like, are we at the point where, like, we all know if you had some great trainer or something, you'd be telling everybody and y'all, oh, this person's made me great or whatever. Are we at that point with mental health? Like, I talked to Dr. Shannon. She's awesome. Everybody should try it.
I definitely think so. I think that's one great part of, you know, the psychological services in athletics, is I feel like at least in our team, on the softball team, it was a culture of encouraging people to get help and, you know, normalizing that we're going to talk to someone and that's completely normal. And I think every team is different, but the softball team, that was something that's very helpful. It was very normal to go and get help and to talk through things, and it was normal to encourage our teammates to do the same.
Does it make you mad that this happened?
Yes. I actually started a blog after I...
Mad blog. Hashtag mad blog.
Yeah, it wasn't quite... I tried to be very cautious about, you know, like feel all those feelings, but try to be productive with it. And I think that was ultimately my goal, was like, listen, this is what we did and this is what worked and didn't work. And like, I want to show you what I did so that you don't have to go through the same thing to find the help you need. But the way the system made me feel when, you know, I am very intelligent, I'm, you know, I want to get things right. I knew I needed help. I mean, I was asking people for help. It was like I was doing all the right things and I still couldn't find the help I needed. And, you know, we made every turn you could possibly make to try to find the help. And then we just kept running into dead ends and we're like, what are we doing wrong?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it took me 10 months to find the help I needed and we were actively seeking it. And so that's what I think. I get really mad sometimes looking back on it, just because I'm like, I'm lucky to have gotten the help that I ultimately needed, which was, you know, me withdrawing from the school and going to a treatment center. But there were so many people that could have helped prior to then that I think were just so like, so used to seeing people struggle that it just wasn't as big of a deal to them.
Mm.
But yeah, it makes me mad and sad and all the things. And at the same time, super grateful I came out the other side, but almost like mad for the people that come after me that have to experience the same thing. Like, we haven't learned from these mistakes yet. Yeah.
I definitely feel like I'm asking questions I'm not qualified to ask. So I screw things up on here all the time and do things wrong and bad and think, well, that was
confirmed, everybody.
Yeah. I mean, Jones out. Knows this firsthand. That was pretty terrible what you just did. What's the separation between I'm feeling bad about what I just did, but I know that I'm okay, versus I feel really bad about myself and I don't think it's okay. Like, how do you tell those things apart?
So, like, sorry, I'm just trying to make sure I understand. So, like, the difference between
I feel like I had a bad day.
Right.
Okay. And I feel like I don't know if I want to have other days.
Right. I think that, you know, now that I'm in recovery, I have bad days where I have the bad day. I reflect on the bad day and I'm like, all right, let's try again tomorrow. I think that when you're in a space of not knowing if you want to have more days, it's like if you were to put blinders on and then also cover your vision in the front, it's like you can't see anything around you and you're like, I don't know what happened yesterday. I don't know what will happen tomorrow, but this right now, I'm not okay and I don't want to be here. It's like you can't see any perspective. And it's actually something I've reflected on a lot, because I think, you know, you have so many, especially in terms of, you know, the conversation about suicide, which I know this might be like a triggering conversation. So, but I think there's a lot of talk about, you know, selfishness sometimes with suicide. And, you know, one of my friends one time asked, like, why is it not selfish? And because she's never experienced any mental health issues. And I'm like, when you're in that position, you have to understand that that person, to them, so like me, when I was suicidal, I was like, how selfish is it for all of you to ask me to continue living when my quality of life right now is so poor? Like, there's this, it's so interesting, though, to have been in those different spots now, because now I look at it and I'm like, you know, there's so much more to life and there's all these people around you that love you and care about you and are going to, you know, suffer from that loss. And it's, you have to understand the difference in perspective for that person that can see nothing else around them except how miserable they are. It's like, this world is better without, like, it's the saddest thing, but that is what it's such a blinding, draining, cyclical thought in your head. And it's something that now I have perspective on, but in that moment I didn't. And I think it's, you know, the bad day is being able to say, well, let's try again tomorrow. The not knowing if you want to have more days is the, like, I don't see any light at the end of the tunnel, and how will tomorrow be different than it is today? So really sad. But yeah, it's it's a matter of perspective, that if you're in that level of crisis and you don't have people around you to help bring you from a 15 to a 5 on that like anxiety or depression level, and you don't have those ways to cope, there's no way for you to bring yourself down enough for you to realize that tomorrow could be different.
All right, before we let you go, if you were running the show, how could everything be, what needs to happen to get better? From a big picture standpoint, how can things improve? How can there be more support? How can there be, like, how do those things happen in your opinion?
Yeah, I think that all medical professionals, whether you're a psychological or just a primary care doctor, I think that they all need to be seriously trained in signs to look for in terms of all mental health issues, whether that be eating disorders, anxiety, depression, all of it. I think that there needs to be new training. And I think that, you know, doctors can have 30 years of experience and they don't understand, you know, the differences in this generation and, you know, the prevalence of eating disorders or, you know, the tendencies of those people. I also think that you have to increase your number of staff. People in CAPS were overworked and understaffed prior to the pandemic, and now it's tenfold. And it's, you know, you have to make those adjustments so that people can get individualized care. Because if people can be able to sit down and have an hour-long session once a week, sometimes that's all the support they need. But you have to make sure you have the resources in place so that people can get on the schedule and so that people can get that help. Because at the end of the day, while Carolina is a great community, you know, you saw last week, it's like peers shouldn't be supporting peers alone in this, you know, the issues with suicide and mental health. It's like you have to have those professionals in place because they're not optional. They're necessary for people struggling. And because, you know, if you're a peer supporting another peer with suicidal thoughts, that's a lot on you as well. You know, if you don't have those people in place, you end up putting a big burden on people struggling and people supporting. So I really think it is a matter of numbers. And I think that's the first place you have to start. You have to give more funding so that you're able to increase your staff.
We appreciate both our guests joining us today. And again, hopefully that was informative for you. And hopefully that is a discussion that can continue to be more at the forefront. Because as I think Adam referenced a couple times in those interviews, you know, everybody's all right talking about a torn ACL or a injured shoulder or anything like that. And this is just, it's a very similar thing. A little different, of course, but it's just about your well-being. So let's hope.
And as both our guests said, something that I think you'll see become more and more part of athletics as things move forward. And 15 years from now, we'll look back on that episode and go, I can't believe we didn't know those things then, or that those things weren't a regular part of life. And now they are.
That'll be when we throw out episode 2000 of the pod.
Looking forward to the wrap for that one.
The pod made it to 2000. Texting while driving takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds at highway speeds. That's like driving the length of a football field, but doing it with your eyes closed. Trusted Choice Independent Insurance Agents of North Carolina wants you to stay safe behind the wheel, so put down that phone while you're driving. And let's have a hands-free NC. To learn more, find an agent near you. You can visit trustedchoice.com/goheels. trustedchoice.com/goheels. Why don't we go to Adam's List?
What's on the top of Adam's List? Brought to you by Top of the Hill, where Tar Heels come to celebrate.
I know everyone was breathless over the weekend waiting for the conclusion to this story. The answer to Boozy Listerine.
Oh, yeah.
Downton Shabby has given us a reply to let us know. If you remember, Downton Shabby's wife wrote Boozy Listerine on the half-ripped envelope that contained his shopping list.
Yep.
And we weren't sure what this was. Well, now we know. He says, that is Boozy Listerine. That's my wife's way of telling me she wants the OG high-test Listerine with alcohol and not the alcohol-free version that some dentists recommend. She advocates a scorched earth approach to oral hygiene.
Burn it all down. Get all those germs out of there.
So I think we now know for sure that is how we will forever know the difference between the kinds of Listerine. Rusty Sebastian has plumbed the depths of the internet and come up with a link for the famous chicken singing / clucking Rod Stewart's massive hit, Do You Think I'm Sexy?
Did I miss this?
I don't know. Did you?
I didn't see this.
He tweeted it to us. Jones, it's a ride. I want to forewarn you. I'm guessing it'll probably be in here. There's no actual singing in this version. There is only clucking.
All right. Well, I'm going to have to go back. I totally missed this. So I'm going to have to go back and if I can find it. And you said this is Rusty Sebastian sent it to us.
Yes.
All right. If I can find it, I will put it in.
I hope everyone enjoyed that. It's really something. Remember, that was 79, 80, somewhere in there. That's what people thought was a good idea then. So you know what? We hadn't got everything figured out in the year 2021, but we're coming along. We're making some progress. Mary Mercer and Andrew Blate both sent this link to Jones about the Hallmark Christmas movie Sweets.
By the way, did I watch a Hallmark Christmas movie this weekend? In fact, Adam, I watched two because there was the original and then the sequel.
What?
It's not often that you get a sequel. That's when you know you got a good one.
Especially in October. What was it?
I want to make sure I get the title exactly right, so you finish your thought and then I'll tell you.
Okay. The link is from southernthing.com. Don't worry, it's safe. You can now spend the night inside a Hallmark Christmas movie at one of these holiday themed suites.
Yep.
SUITES. Hallmark Channel and a big hotel company have partnered to create three suites inspired by Hallmark's Countdown to Christmas at timeshare resorts in New York City. We'll be there for the ACC tournament, but they probably won't be open. Nashville, Tennessee. I could easily go on a field trip to that one. And Vail, Colorado. Each of the festively decorated rooms is themed after backdrops from some of the channel's most popular holiday films, with special seasonal amenities like an ornament crafting station. Mm. Who doesn't want that in their hotel room? Hot cocoa station, gingerbread house kits, wrapped presents under Christmas trees, and of course, a Hallmark Channel holiday movie collection with popcorn and candy included. Now, when we watched that one last year, remember we talked about how that inn was decorated.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And how merry it was. You could live inside of that.
I think it's funny that of all the things on the podcast, this may be the one that has caught on the most.
It might be.
Is the love for Hallmark Christmas movies.
I think everyone can relate to this, or else there wouldn't be this many Hallmark Christmas movies.
Okay, so I saw A Gift to Remember and A Gift to Remember 2.
Starring?
These two pleasant-looking people. So in the first one, the woman, I think her name was Darcy, she hit this guy when she was on her bike, and Adam, he got amnesia.
Uh-oh.
Oh, yeah. It was a wild ride. But I'm just going to clue you in. They did end up together at the end of the first one.
Mm.
So fast forward to the second one. And I mean, Adam, there was small town bookstore that's in trouble. Mm. There was special Christmas memories from growing up that now are bringing back all kinds of feelings. Plus, there's the amnesia aspect that I had never even thought about before.
Right. Maybe because you had amnesia.
Yeah. And in the second one, the like community center's about to go under. I mean, every box that could be checked got checked. There was a dog involved, too, as you can see.
So the dog's not in the sequel?
No, the dog is in the sequel. Bailey was the dog's name. Played a big role in the first one. Not as big in the second one. And I think they changed dogs, Adam. I think they tried to make us...
sneaky.
I mean, I'd hate to know what happened to Bailey, number one. But I think they just tried to throw some dog that kind of looked like this dog and trick me into thinking it was the same dog. Not the same dog.
Well, Bailey's on the poster for one, but didn't make the poster for two.
Not nearly as big a role in the second one.
Well,
neither was Nurse Nancy, who was the guy's nurse in the first one, but she just makes a cameo in the second one.
Well,
the competitor to their small bookstore was called Books, Books, Books.
Were there any big city tycoons with a heart of stone?
Oh, yeah, in the second one for sure. Mm. Hopefully that... maybe the Christmas spirit's going to melt that heart a little bit, though, Adam.
It feels like that was a good way for you to kick off the Christmas movie season.
It was a good one. It was a good one.
Are you planning to go one every weekend from now until the holidays?
I'm going to have time, Adam. Yeah. The bye week is what allowed me some time.
Sam, I know we're here on the plane to Pittsburgh. I wonder if you could slide over so I could pop in this DVD of the Christmas movie I've been watching. I know you're watching game film of Pitt's Cover 2 Zone.
Instead, you want to watch this with me? Here, check it out. Okay, now. She now works for a big city marketing firm in New York. Can you believe it?
But she's never lost that small town charm.
There's this conductor.
Got an email from Michelle Defoe, who, as we know, is a member of the 100% Pod Club. She wanted to give us a quick correction to how we were pronouncing the name of her high school and college friend, Aaron Napel.
Ooh.
It's Aaron Napel, rhymes with Bell. So thank you, Michelle.
I wish, Adam, when you go back and listen to that, you're going to hear how many little rhymes that you did. Like, Michelle
Ball?
Defoe wants us to know. And then you're like, rhymes with Bell. Thanks, Michelle. Joke's on you, Michelle. Adam can't pronounce anything. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it was nothing personal to Aaron. It was more just my everyday life. Jonathan Prescott also sent an email. This was really an informative one. He heard the discussion about the case of the missing Florida State tape, Encyclopedia Brown, Volume 6.
Oh, yeah. This was informative.
While Jonathan knows we'd like to eventually find the missing master recording, as we call it in the biz, Jonathan has... what sounds like it might be slightly illegal, but also awesome. He has a recording of that game as it was broadcast on what was then WZZU 93.9 94Z. Listen to it all the time. Which was the FM affiliate in the Triangle. One of my dorm mates videotaped the games that season with the audio track from the radio broadcast, and Jonathan has a copy of that game, along with Cincinnati, Kansas, Michigan. Unfortunately,
I hope he didn't sell that because this broadcast is only for personal consumption only, as brought to you by the rights protected by the University of North Carolina and, at the time, I guess, the Village Companies.
I think the statute of limitations is up. I grant Jonathan amnesty by the powers vested in me by absolutely nobody. Ultimately, the recording does not include the post-game show with Mick's poem. What a loss. But it does have the entire second half with the comeback, which includes a couple of Jonathan's favorite quotes from both Woody and Mick. With the comeback complete, they both laid out and let the crowd noise play for several seconds, pro move, and then Mick simply said, "I'd like a rosé and maybe some cheddar." Classic Mick, says Jonathan. Then after the final horn, as Woody is going to break, he says, "Miracles don't just happen in Chapel Hill, they usually happen."
I think I remember Woody saying that.
I definitely feel like I've heard that somewhere before, which could be because, as Jonathan says, the DTH used that as their daily quote on the next morning's front page. And we'll use that front page on the video pod this week. So if you'd like to see it, there it is. Jonathan knows his recording probably isn't as good as the master copy would be. Hey, look, you haven't heard all these master copies.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's
Don't jump to conclusions.
Sometimes just somebody holding a tape recorder up to a telephone. He'd be happy to provide a copy if you'd like to have it to fill that hole in the archives, and he can even provide the video with the audio. Jonathan, you've got a treasure trove, sir. Yeah. So, thank you. But we still don't have Mick's poem. Somewhere out there.
It's coming on a white whale.
It exists.
We're going to have to find it.
I want to conclude with a what up. This is purely for informational purposes.
Okay.
From Cardinal Gibbons. Broke TJ Logan's single game rushing record, which has stood since 2012 in the state of North Carolina. Listen to this. 19 carries, 539 yards.
Wow.
6 touchdowns. He played 3 quarters.
Mm.
That was against Athens Drive. So, I actually know... He played baseball with Asher back in the day at West Raleigh. What up, buddy? That's pretty awesome. And even if you decide not to play football in college, that's awesome.
Adam does these things just because he knows I'm going to have to go in there and like beep out names and do just to make it hard. He's like, oh, Jones, here, let's make your Monday as you prepare for this Tuesday episode a little bit harder.
Sounds like somebody's got a case of the Mondays.
He's a personal acquaintance. Pre-existing relationship. That's awesome. That 539 yards on the ground in 3 quarters on 19 carries. Not like he carried it 60 times.
I bet the Athens Drive message boards were after that defensive coordinator's head after that game.
You've besmirched the good name of the Jags.
Hey, let's look back at the weekend that was, find some champions of Tar Heel Athletics, brought to you by UNC Health, dedicated to caring for champions of all kinds and to help keep you in the game and at your very best. See their lineup at unchealthcare.org/sports, unchealthcare.org/sports. Adam Anson Dorrance, 900 career wins, big time.
The next closest college coach on the women's side has 570. He's 330 ahead of the next closest women's college coach. And don't forget, he's got like 170 or something more wins on the men's side.
So two really good games this past weekend for women's soccer. They tied Florida State, who was number one at the time, although Florida State then lost to Duke, I think, 2-1 maybe. That was a 2-2 tie, and then beat Notre Dame in overtime 2-1. So... it was a intense weekend for women's soccer. Get the one win, the one tie. I know they're frustrated with the tie because they had the lead with like 15 minutes left against Florida State, but the Seminoles were able to tie it up. But I tell you, man, every team in the ACC is going to be battle-tested for NCAA tournament. Who knows what will happen? But they have all played great teams because the ACC is just loaded. Virginia, Duke, Florida State, Carolina. I mean, these are all – really, really good teams.
Well, Notre Dame's number 15 in the country.
Yeah.
And you don't even think of them as being necessarily one of the best out of that group. They're still in the top 15 nationally. So all those teams going to feel like that first weekend of the NCAA tournament, a little bit of a breather almost. Only 6 make the ACC tournament.
Yeah, that's right. If I'm not mistaken, Carolina's actually outside of the ACC tournament right now. They only have 1 match left. So, of course, you get 3 points for a win, 1 point for a tie. And so Carolina needs some points. They're actually a point out right now, even though they're ranked like number 7 in the nation,
right?
Which is crazy. Why are there only 6 teams in the tournament? Well, everybody plays the sport.
And if you're going to have a decreased number for the tournament, why not do 8? Because that makes a tournament so much easier.
Well, I said everybody plays. There's only 14 teams that play. Not
still,
15.
Leave
I
don't out
I think,
6.
I think Georgia Tech doesn't play. Anyway, we didn't get a chance to make that decision.
When we design all the ACC championship brackets, it'll be different.
Yeah, we got it. Okay, later in the week, we will preview Notre Dame football. We have great guest. I think you're really going to enjoy it. We know Adam's mom will. Wink, wink.
Andy Griffith's going to be on here? What's the entire cast of MASH doing on the Carolina Insider?
So, we've got a great guest. we will, like I said, preview the football matchup with Notre Dame, 5-second challenge, and a lot more. But for now, Adam, we got all these. Yeah, we've got Dr. Jenny Shannon. We've got Katie Grace Olinger. We've got the RZA. Three people who are at the forefront of the mental health discussion. That'll get us out of here on the latest edition of the Carolina Insider.
I'm Jenny Shannon, and see you later, Big Grits.
I'm Katie Grace Olinger. See you later, Big Grits.
When I was small, we had nothing at all. We used to eat grits for dinner.
Pound box of sugar and a stick of margarine. A hot pot of grits kept my family from starving. Steamy hot meal served less than 5 minutes. Big silver pot boiling water salt in it. House full of brothers and sisters, the pot's missing. Pilgrim on a box on the stove in the kitchen.
When I was small, we had nothing at all. We used to eat.
The preceding has been a Learfield presentation of the Tar Heel Sports Network.